Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The smell of a roast in the oven or a freshly baked pie in your childhood home may be what sends you. For somebody else, it's a plate of rabbit ribs with foamed aioli or green beans and shallots. New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik says that taste and even our taste buds are products of time and place and culture and history. It's all those that give the table, the meal, its wonder. This hour on Point, Adam Gopnik on the meaning of food. Joining me now from Toronto is Adam Gopnik, New Yorker writer and habitué of Paris and restaurant tables, author of the celebrated collection of essays Paris to the Moon, sometime cook in his own home. His new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Adam Gopnik, welcome. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
I wish you'd start us right off, just to give a sense of the way you come into this. On May 24th, 1942, 6:40 in the morning, and what's going on with the most unlikely reference to food?
There's a man, a resistance fighter named Jacques Decoeur. His real name, that was his resistance name. His real name was Daniel Decoeur de Manche. And he's writing a letter to his parents. And in this letter, he talks about the things that have been most important to his life. And he's writing this letter because he's about to be executed by the Nazis for having been a resistor. And in this letter, he doesn't talk about his religion. He doesn't talk about the values of the Republic or of the resistance that he's fighting and will die for. He talks about food. He lists all of the restaurants where he and his parents have eaten well. He asks his parents to send the menu from an inn called the Auberge de Catois to his girlfriend. And he says quietly at the end of this letter, as you can see, questions of food have taken on great importance.
And 3 hours later, he is in fact executed in the courtyard of his prison there.
Exactly so. And I was so stunned when I read this letter, Tom, because it sort of was one of those things that make you stop full and say, what did he mean by questions of food? Why would he go to such trouble to detail these things for his parents? Why was his head filled with these images at the last moment of his life? He obviously didn't mean sort of lip-smackingly, those were delicious meals.
Yeah.
It's too grave a moment for that. And he also obviously didn't mean, as we might mean, boy, that was my favorite chef, and I hope he wins on TV tonight. And he didn't mean, I know that all the zucchini was properly sourced
that
we ate there.
Right.
He was talking about something deeper and more profound, more permanent. He was talking about the way that his life had been shaped by the continuities of the table, that if he was struggling at the last moment of his life to define the values and pleasures that he was willing to die for, they had something to do with the joys of a common table. They had something to do with the way we punctuate and celebrate and fill our lives with food. And when I came upon that letter, I thought, this is where I have to start. This is like the Zen koan that I have to ask myself if I'm going to write about food. What did Jacques Decoeur mean when he said, questions of food have taken on great importance?
Even at that penultimate moment, he's writing to his parents from the prison. Well, he will within hours be shot. He says, you know that for the past 2 months I've been expecting what is to happen to me this morning. He's fully aware. He writes, all these last days I've thought a lot about the good meals that we should have together when I was free. That will never happen, of course. He says, you will eat them without me, all the family together, but not sadly, please. Adam Gopnik starts right off in his new book with that anecdote and takes it into the meaning of food. Now, meaning of food is not a phrase that we hear just every day. You know, people talk about the taste, they talk about the flavor, they talk about the, as you indicate, the source, you know, where does it come from? But the meaning, what takes you there?
Well, I think the meaning is the thing, in a funny way, Tom, it's the thing that we all know, first of all, we all know best. In other words, when we're unselfconsciously relating, narrating the stories of our lives, as Jacques Decoeur was doing in that moment of utter urgency, what do we talk about? We talk about food. Charles Darwin, you know, one of my heroes, one of all of our heroes, said once, we have happy days, we remember good dinners. Dinner, lunch, the great meals of our lives are sort of these little focusing glasses, you know, like the kids use magnifying glasses to burn holes in paper. They let us burn our way through life. That's what we remember. Our happy days tend to coalesce, condense into the great meals we've shared. And not just great meals in the sense of, you know, my anniversary dinner at Thai Avant or something like that, but the meals we've had throughout our lives, the Christmas dinners, the Thanksgiving dinners. Most of all, I think, the everyday dinner, the dinner that we've made over and over for our family, the dinner that we've shared with the people we love. If you think about it, most lives, most sort of ordinary lives in our culture are punctuated by dinners. Where do we go when we're first interested in another person? We take them out to a restaurant. Where are we likely to make the proposal? Where's the place that we think is safe enough to say, you know, this isn't really working out, right? It's going to be across another table. So it's that much larger, humane role that the table and food plays in our lives. That's where I think you begin to find the true meanings of food rather than in the kind of macho celebration of, you know, I just ate this rattlesnake testicle ragu that you find on television or in, you know, our obsessions with where it came from, all of which I should add, Tom, I share. You know, I am like the worst carry nation of a pre-sweetened cereal. If the kids smuggle in, you know, honey sweet, honey suckle Cheerios,
right.
I find it in the cupboard and I throw it out and I rage and I, you know, the broccoli's not organic. I share all of those tastes and I believe in them. But I also recognize that they're the tastes of our time and that the real meaning of food lies in much longer continuities of shared pleasure.
You're right. You say an obsessive interest in food is not a rich man's indulgence. Everybody, many can have it, i.e. if you can afford it, if you're not eating just whatever you can get at the cheapest possible price, I suppose,
yes,
from the supermarket. You say more people talk about food now, why they eat, what they eat, and what you ought to eat than have ever done before. Our food has become our medicine, our source of macho adventure, rattlesnake testicle ragu. Sometimes it almost seems our messianic material. What do you mean by that, Adam?
Well, that we seem to believe that if we could get our food right, if we could eat the right way, then we would save the planet, we would save ourselves, live indefinitely, live in kind of Eden, that food has become sort of a material that we all use in a world that's increasingly secularized, I suppose, Tom, that's a large part of it, that, you know, it's a very natural thing for people. It's a weird thing if you think about it at all. We have a hard time thinking about food as art, and it makes us a little uncomfortable. Mm. But boy, we don't have a hard time thinking of food as the material for faith. Every religion of any kind has dietary rules, or you believe that a wafer can become the body of your God. We make an association very naturally and instinctively between food and faith. And those of us who live in a society like our own where official faith, organized religion plays less importance, turn to food itself as ways of sort of organizing our lives, expressing our values. What's the most kind of immediate way we all express our values these days? It's what we put on the table. If you go to somebody's house and they're serving you bread that they've baked themselves, locally sourced zucchini, no meat of any kind, certainly no industrialized meat. Boy, you know an enormous amount about everything that they value and believe.
That's what's on the table. It can be wonderful. It can go, and you warn against this, it can go to a kind of zealotry. But when you write about Jacques Decour, you're also looking at, I mean, you say, you know, his questions that he's posing in his last letter to his parents before his execution, they're almost humanist. He says he's talking about what goes on around the table as much as what's on it, Adam.
Yes, that's right. I think they're profoundly humanist in every sense. And yes, I think that we need to think more. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, we need to think more about what goes on around the table and make that in greater balance with what specifically is on the table. As I say, I care passionately about what's on the table, and I share all of those kinds of tastes. Those are the people I eat with and the people I learn from are people who obsess about these things. But I recognize that our tastes will certainly change. Unless history is stopped, Tom, stopped cold, tastes will go on changing. Because we know when we look back, we know that the food of 25 years ago, what everybody thought was good food 25 years ago, looks to us dubious. And the good food of 50 years ago always looks to us indigestible. And the good food of 100 years ago always looks to us now inedible. Unless history is stopped, that's going to go on. But what is it that connects all of those changing tastes? What's the continuity that still brings us together around the table in perpetuity? It isn't the thing that's on the table. It's the spirit that goes on around it.
For that, you have gone in your life very often to France. Now you're based in Toronto today, but you're based in the U.S. Is France, you describe it as a kind of Shangri-La in some of your essays for that life around the table. Is there still that big margin of advantage there? Are Americans all, you know, eating on the run, on the hoof?
Well, I have, you know, I'm one of the things this book is about, I guess, is I have complicated, ambivalent, ambiguous feelings, as we do, about places we love and about people we love in this. I think that France still represents the kind of primal source of our civilization of gastronomy, of our civilization of the table. If you think about it, the Great Revolution in American cooking that began in the 1960s and stretches on was a French Revolution. Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Alice Waters' Chez Panisse, based on a French movie. Those were the places. France is the place where civilization of food first got elaborate, first got humanized, to use that word. But at the same time, I think any honest eater has to recognize that French food has become less and less important to us as eaters. I think most people, sort of the food I cook for my kids and my wife 6 days a week is much more likely to be Italian or a Thai green curry than it is to be a Côte de Veau foyot. And at the same time, even those of us who are passionate Francophiles have to admit that the food that we eat in Paris these days tends to be much more old-fashioned, tends to be much more traditional, even if you like sort of entombed within a traditional manner, than the food we might find in London or Sydney or San Francisco.
Adam Gopnik, this is fun already, and we've got much more to go. It's so great to have you with us. Adam Gopnik, New Yorker writer, joins us from Toronto today. His new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about food and the meaning of food with New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik. His new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Adam, you've got a terrific poem from W.H. Auden right at the front of the book. I wonder if you could read just that last passage for us. It's so wonderful, kind of gets us right down in the trench with you here.
With pleasure. Auden's my favorite poem. My son is called Luke Auden. We gave him that name because I love Auden so much. And Auden writes, "The sin of gluttony is ranked among the deadly seven. But in murder mysteries, one can be sure the gourmet didn't do it. Children, brave warriors out of a job, can weigh pounds more than they should, and one can dislike having to kiss them. Yet, compared with the thin-lipped, they are seldom detestable. Some waiter grieves for the worst dead boar to be a good trencherman. And no wonder chefs mature into choleric types, doomed to observe beauty peck at a master dish. Their one reward, to behold the mutually hostile mouth and eyes of a sinner married at the first bite by a smile."
It's just one of Auden's On Installing an American Kitchen in Lower Austria, read by Adam Gopnik, no less. What's he talk? You talk a lot about chefs in here and restaurants. We'll come to that. But when he says, no wonder chefs mature into choleric types, you know, of ill-tempered types, what's he going at there?
Well, I think he's catching exactly the funny ambivalence of a chef's life, which in a way speaks to the larger ambivalence of the table in lots of ways. Chefs work incredibly hard. They're, if you have ever been in a French kitchen, I've been lucky enough to work in a couple, it is, you know, a miserable place in lots of ways. And they say, sale métier, filthy occupation, filthy occupation. It's such hard work. You start at 5 in the morning, you chop onions, you're just in heat and misery. And yet, the reward for the chef of that moment that Auden describes so beautifully, when some overweight sinner takes a bite and they watch, you know, beauties peck at a great dish. You make something perfect and Jacqueline Bisset sends it back, right? Because there's too much oil on it. But there's that one moment, right, when they can see somebody takes a bite and a look of absolute beatific pleasure spreads over their face. And that's good enough to make the chef go on. And that kind of doubleness in the experience of being a cook, absolute exhaustion, total epiphany, that's one of the things I think that makes them such fascinating people to be with. I love spending time with chefs because they're the sort of last people, Tom, who have total manual labor, total exhausting manual labor. They're kind of like flunkies. They live on other people's approval. And yet they have this wonderful, secret, elaborate craft that only they have mastered.
And that plays with what you call the double nature of desire. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is just that desire pulls us in two different ways. It pulls us selfishly inward so that we're just trying to, you know, it's like I wrap my hand around the plate and I shovel the food in, right? And I really love it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, desire pulls us towards other people inevitably. It pulls us to shared desires, shared pleasures. And that's true about sex, right? It's completely selfish in one way and completely selfless in another way. You're sharing pleasure fully with another person. And food every day unless you're lucky enough to be having sex three times a day. Food three times a day is the one time when we replicate that experience, when it's completely selfish and at the same time shared.
This is great.
That's the double nature of desire.
Double nature right there. Adam Gopnik is with us. His new book is The Table Comes First. And Adam, we've got people lined up to sit at your table. I want to bring them in. Jane in Lake Placid, New York. You're on with Adam Gopnik. Jane, what's your story?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Adam. I admire you both immensely, and I'm a big reader of The New Yorker. I just have a quick story to tell you, which is so beautiful. I live with a group of people who are in a book club. We all have different houses. We all come from different places. In the book club is a woman from Padua, Italy. Mm. And in the December of last year, she invited us all to her wedding in Padua. So we all saved up our money. We all went over there, and we rented a space, a little house of our own, which was very nice. And because we came all the way from New York State, family invited us to have a dinner at our place where we had a pool. And the family brought a six-course meal, which the dinner lasted from 1 to 5.
Lovely.
And I thought it was a sweet story you should know because everybody shared a good time.
And the whole afternoon, just rolling away.
Yep. Well, we did swim.
That's great.
But the family brought out to the pool gelato, and then we brought out liqueurs. And we were there for 8 days, and it was the best day. And it was so important to feel about them the way they felt about us. And it was so sweet.
And food pulls it together. I love it. The four-hour lunch, the 8 days, the six-course meal, and the family brings it all. It's all about, Adam, you write, what different cultures and subcultures bring to that table. You can find the community, the communion, maybe on a thousand paths, but different bearers bringing different cultures
exactly.
to that table.
You know, if you think about it, Tom, the truth is the world eats one common meal. We eat a neutral starch with a pungent protein, whether that's pizza, right, or a curry served on rice, or spiced ants on cassava, whatever that is. That's basically sitting right now, a billion people will sit down to eat a neutral starch and a pungent protein. So in one way, we all share the same thing, and yet the manners, the inflections, the way we do it, the difference between that Italian meal that our friend had and the way it would be done in France, which would be much more formal. They wouldn't just bring the food over, but you'd spend the same 5 hours. You know, the other thing that story makes me think of is how time has become a crucial ingredient in modern cooking. That, you know, it used to be that protein was the rarest thing. Now we live in times of relative abundance, and God knows that it's not sufficient abundance, and that's something we all should always be aware of when we talk about food. But in a time of relative abundance, time becomes the most valuable commodity. How long do you have to spend on this? And the simple act of spending 5 hours, as that lady did, is in itself an experience of taste.
Lee in Lexington, Massachusetts. Lee, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Adam Gopnik.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Gopnik. It's just a pleasure, and I've enjoyed your writing for a great while, and I can't wait to read the book, so thank you.
Thank you.
I come from a family in which food is absolutely social capital. It is history. It's ritual, and I'm sure you can tell that means my family is from the South. And the one thing I might respectfully disagree with is that, you know, we do still make recipes, certainly at holiday times, that my family has made for 300 years, and including a plum pudding that uses lamb suet, which is getting increasingly difficult to locate. I was in a relationship with somebody for 3 years whose family was completely different about food. And I just wanted to mention this because it's so relevant to the topic. It's I had to explain to this gentleman at one point that, you know, in my mother's kitchen, in his mother's kitchen, everything was a democracy. Anyone was expected to be able to come in and find a dish and help out and set the table. It was all, you know, everyone was expected to do. And I had to explain to him that my mother's kitchen was a benevolent dictatorship. It was just totally, totally different. And that she really wanted to, that when food is a ritual, that it's not just open to everybody, that there are ways, and you kind of have to tune into those ways. It was just fascinating and really taught me a lot.
Adam,
You're absolutely right. A good kitchen is always an autocracy, and it's always got a little dictator at its center. My mom was the dictator in our family kitchen, and I now am the miserable little dictator there, you know, because when you're a cook, you have to say, I want it now, you know. Can you get me the cinnamon? I don't need it in 30 seconds. I need it this second. Cooking is so susceptible to those things. So I've actually been through sous chefs in the form of my own family. We fired my wife as the first sous chef. I hired my son. He wasn't. Now my daughter, my 12-year-old daughter, is the standard sous chef. But that's part of the fun of food and part of the fun of cooking is it is an autocracy. It's not a democracy. We have high standards
of excellence. So you say, but there Lee was dating this guy, and in his house it was. It was a democracy, and no doubt
who's
they...
On whose table do you think we found better food, Lee or this guy's thing? I'll bet. The other thing, I think she's absolutely right. Yeah. The South in the United States is one of the places where we still have a food culture of that kind. My friend Roy Blunt Jr. has this wonderful thing just about the dialogue around a Southern Thanksgiving table where people say, I can't get my pastry to do like this. And she says, oh, I've tasted your pie crust. It does fine.
I love the way you describe all these cultures coming to the table, and anybody who crosses those boundaries knows how that works. I mean, you know, I came in to the tutelage of a French-born and raised Parisian father-in-law, and believe me, that brought a whole new sort of a complexion to food, a fantastic complexion. But this issue that you talk so much and think so much about of taste and how we develop each our own, those threads that come toward the table, and how variable taste can be, how our very understanding of what's tasty even changes over time, over geography, over culture, over
changes
experience.
Changes depending on the frame that we put it in. You know, if you put local from Montana on a bottle of great French wine and you give it to professional wine tasters, they'll all rate it lower. They'll say, oh, this is Montana wine or rather than French wine. Can I read you a little bit from the book here where I tried to sum up what I think about taste? I write, there's a long chapter about taste and about how all the variations of taste might make you think, oh, well, it's all just fad and fashion. But in fact, there's a kind of core to it. Mm. Chop wood, carry water, bake your cake, then you have it, then you eat it. The submission to sequence is the source of the sublime. Taste is only the art of knowing little things. That's what Rousseau, the great philosopher, once said dismissively about taste. That's what makes it big. In republics, as in the kitchen, it's the little things, respected for themselves, rather than pureed into sameness, that make the finest sauces. Taste begins at the door and ends in our dreams. It is not on our tongues or in our hearts or in our minds or our social roles, but all of those places at once. Taste is choice, taste is labor, taste is work, and taste is everywhere and results from everything. I have a friend who's a wonderful chef in New York, and we were once talking about this, and he said, what non-chefs don't understand is that taste begins at the door. It's when you walk into the door of my restaurant that your taste begins. And everything you see and everyone who greets you affects the taste of what's on your plate.
You write even about a moral taste. What do you mean there, Adam?
I think one of the fascinating things about the history of food is we all have mouth taste, the way food tastes to us, you know, when we put it on our tongue. And those tastes immediately translate into moral taste. For instance, you know, we were talking before, if you have a mouth taste for organic, locally sourced zucchini, it immediately turns into a moral taste. You feel that you are a better person for liking those things. But that hasn't always been the case. You know, 100 years ago, if you were somebody who liked strawberries out of season or you could get a lobster shipped in from France, we would never do that now. It's too far to go, right? Mm. We would think it's better if it comes from near rather than if it comes from far. But then, too, that mouth taste for the strawberries in December immediately translated into a moral taste. I'm a sophisticated person. Mm. So one of the things that's fascinating about thinking about food is the way that those seemingly simple physical sensory mouth tastes always become a moral taste. What we eat isn't so much what we are as how we choose to present ourselves.
And what do you think about all the focus on healthy eating in recent years? I mean, Lee calls and mentions lamb soot in the plum pudding. This is not going to get your cardiologist seal of approval. Nevertheless, it probably creates one quite amazing plum pudding. What about the health consciousness and the way it intersects with our pleasure at the table?
As I say, and this is the double nature of desire, I share all of these worries. I'm the guy who puts, you know, red meat on the family table once every 2 weeks, and we have meatless Mondays, and I participate in all of that. I am a child of my time. But I also recognize that our knowledge of what is healthy and isn't healthy changes all the time. And that throughout human history, not always, pleasure tends to be a pretty good sorting principle where, you know, mortality is not a choice. It's not something we can evade. You know, the way I like to put it sometimes, Tom, is to say, imagine if, like in the Matrix, right, you have the red pill and the blue pill. Yeah. Imagine if we had a green pill. You could just take the green pill and it would give you endlessly extended longevity and it would be good for the planet. But you would have to stop cooking and
but
eating
no dinner.
The things we like.
Right.
But no dinner. Choice, green pill or no dinner.
Oh, boy.
Which would you take? Which would you take?
I'm afraid
I'd
I'm
take
a pushover
over
on
the,
that.
I'd take dinner over the green pill. And I think even the most determined moralizing eaters would take dinner before the green pill.
I'd take dinner by a country mile. Claire in Winchester, Virginia. Claire, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Adam Gopnik, I really enjoy your writing.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to tell a little story about last night I made potato gnocchi for the first time in 30 years. I learned it from some distant relatives in Italy. And I used to make it when I was in my 20s. My husband really enjoyed it. And that's what he asked for his birthday dinner last night.
Nice.
And it was really fun. And my daughter really enjoyed it. She'd never made pasta before. And it's sort of funny how we forget how those simple pleasures really are something that draws your family together.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, I'm a total gnocchi failure, I have to say. There's certain dishes I cook almost every night, and there's certain things I can never do right. Gnocchi's one of them, and anything that calls for a salt crust, you know, where you build a paste of salt over a chicken or a duck and then roast it, I always fail at. I break the crust, and the salt all collapses down to the thing I'm cooking. I've tried gnocchi many times, and I envy you being able to pull it off. I can't.
Claire, I'm glad. And the idea of pulling the husband's or the spouse's, the mate's favorite dish out and doing it with your hands for the birthday, it's a great gift. Julia in Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Julia. You're on the air.
I have this wonderful, there's so many anecdotes, and, you know, food is so important to so many people, but there's this TV show from the 90s, My So-Called Life, and there's this wonderful scene. Yes?
Yeah. Yes, we're listening. Go ahead. My So-Called Life.
So there's this wonderful scene in My So-Called Life where the angsty teenager Angela, her narration in her head is, I just couldn't bring myself to eat 3 square meals a day. It meant too much to my mom. And so there's this kind of ambivalence that you were speaking of before. And also this, like, the food is love can actually also kind of turn on its head and be like the lack of food is kind of like a rebellion, you know. So there's, like,
the fact that
food has so much emotional tension.
Julia, thanks.
That's exactly
Adam.
The moment when the mouth taste becomes a moral taste, right? And anyone who has adolescent children knows that, right, that they give you that kind of baleful look. On the one hand, they don't want to do anything that suggests that their autonomy is limited by pleasing you. On the other hand, the chocolate molten cake tastes pretty good, so they're going to have it. And you always feel that ambiguity with kids. I always say, your children will never say, about anything you cook. They'll say, oh, good. It's good.
And off they go.
And you dine on that little wafer of their approval.
Right. But they know that just putting their feet under the table is a big act in itself to your My So-Called Life resistor to exactly that. Show up. There's something going on. Don't show up. There's something missed. Adam Gopnik is with us. His new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about food and the meaning of food with New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik. His new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. All kinds of response, Adam, here on Twitter. Beth says, I enjoy and appreciate food more, not less, now that I think more about healthy meals and local food. Nutrick writes about the labor of love that goes into it. He says, you're so right. I worked harder in all the kitchens I've cooked in than I did as a grunt in the first Gulf War. By far, it's absolute exhaustion, but the reward is just awesome. Feeding everyone is ultimate joy. It is manual labor, and when you talk to farmers who love their work, they too get off on the thrill of feeding people in their glory. A lot more. Not everybody's happy. Drew says, how do we eat fast and cheap? Yes, it is tragic. Anne in Essex, Massachusetts. Anne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm South African, and when I was 18 years old and a student, I bought a a table, an oak leaf table, on an auction for about 14 rand, which is probably about $2. Mm-hmm. And I've kept it my whole life. I'm now 56. And when we moved to America, I wanted to bring it. And my husband said, no, we're not paying all this money to bring this table. And I said, no, I have to, because this table has been the raft of our lives, as your guest put it. All my children, I've got four children who are all away from home now, and they all remember sitting around the table at numerous dinners, especially in the evenings. On Sundays, we would always have pancakes. It's like a tradition, and they're called crepes in America.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to have a savory pancake before you could have a sweet one. It was a rule that we had to have intelligent conversation at the table. So, yes, our table is... I've still got that table in my home in Essex now, and it's very important to us.
Sounds like heaven, and indeed the raft of That's your beautiful. Life. We don't always achieve that, but it's so beautiful, Adam. And, Adam, it's when we get it, it's so great.
That's a beautiful story, absolutely. That, you know, the title of the book comes from a friend of mine, Fergus Henderson, who's a chef in London. And he said to me once, I don't understand how a young couple starting out in life can buy a bed or a sofa or a television set. Don't they know the table comes first? Just like our South African caller, South African-born caller, taking a table through life with her.
We've got Jerry in Burlington, Vermont. Jerry, thanks for calling.
Yes. I wanted to share a little memory I have. When I was in my late teens, I was out of work for longer than I want to remember, 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I ate practically nothing in that period of time. You wouldn't believe it if I told you how little. I fixated on something from my childhood in Brooklyn, and that was shrimp with lobster sauce, or lobster Cantonese, the same dish.
In your imagination, in your mind's eye.
I mean, in Brooklyn, we were able to get some good food, you know, Italian and Chinese particularly. Anyway, and my family's Jewish, so we got great stuff in there. Mm. But I focused on that one dish, and after I got my job back, I went to a Chinese restaurant nearby, and I had that dish, and it was like fantasy. It was unbelievably good, you know, better than my memory.
That's nice, because...
Yeah, Adam.
No, just mental eating is often more satisfying than the other kind. The other thing is that our conditions of scarcity, which we find ourselves in occasionally in life, give us enormous pleasure, too, in another kind. When I first started off as a writer in New York 30 years ago, on a very limited budget, I would eat two meals a day at Papaya King, a hot dog stand on 86th Street and 3rd Avenue. And, you know, it was $3 for lunch. And I walk my kids by there every day and say, that's where your dad did his finest eating.
Yes, hunger, it makes it so acute. I mean, it's hard to talk about when we do have hungry people. And yet there's Jerry. And in that moment, when he felt that hunger, it made that memory so keen. Even the sense, I remember being in Cambodia, not long after all the Pol Pot madness, and there was so little food there. They were serving grass soup nearly in new restaurants there. The flavors that came up in that environment, though, from what you thought there might be no flavor there, but it was there, just not overwhelming. Here's a web comment, Adam, from Dan. He says, how can we expect all American families to try and follow this when we have millions of families, urban and rural, without the means to buy fresh vegetables, healthy food, to properly feed their families? Couple that with the number of families in these situations without someone who can cook, and all you have left is a concept that works for those who can afford it, not those who need it. You know what he's talking about there, Adam.
I do indeed, and I try and write about that in the book. I'm completely conscious of that. I'd just say a few things about it. One is that we're living, more and more, we're able to find sustainable and local produce being grown. Secondly, the historical reality is that though hunger still haunts us on the margins of our civilization, for the great majority of human history, famine was a reality for the majority of people. It was a specter that hung over the whole civilization. And blessedly, that's no longer the case in our abundant North American and European tables. And that's a positive thing that we should never forget. It's one of the great developments of our civilization. I never want to seem to be putting down in any way all of the movements that are designed to get people to eat better, to eat, to grow in more sustainable ways, or anything of the kind. I do think, though, that the reason that those things matter, as one of your Twitterers said, is exactly because they make us pay more attention to the things that are on our plate. What I would love to see, and what I think that I think we condescend to people if we say, "Oh, they can't really care about good food." It's exactly what you were just saying about the Cambodian experience. It's exactly at the moments of distress and extremis that people do care, like Jacques Decour in his last hours. And I think that it is exactly that common humanity that we want to share. And I think that everybody wants to eat well. Everybody wants to eat well. And our job as citizens is to see that everybody can, but not to pretend that eating well is a special preoccupation of an elite.
Your anchor here, right in your title, is France. You range widely, though. I mean, in your observation, do all cultures have this centrality of the table when it comes to human connection? Or is that actually, you know, a setting or metaphor that's more powerful in some cultures than others? I mean, maybe there are cultures where food's not the thing that sets off the great conversation or the great experience in life. I mean, I suppose you're not eating when you're doing Zen meditation, let's say.
Although even Zen folks care about it. I remember Alice Waters, the wonderful cook, was talking about how her proudest meal was the one she made for the Dalai Lama, who incidentally is not a vegetarian, the Tibetan Buddhists are not. I don't claim omniscience. I don't know about what everybody in the world, but, you know, the oldest story we have, the oldest written story, you know, the tale of Gilgamesh, right?
Yes.
And it's all about the civilizing power of food. Enkidu, the half man, the savage man, meets a prostitute, a courtesan, and she tells him, "You must drink the drink," meaning a kind of early wine, "and eat the good food." That in the earliest record we have of civilization, the civilizing act is eating and drinking in the company of others. So I would think that it would be very difficult to find a civilization for whom food isn't at the heart. As I said before, the great specter of famine has always haunted the table and still does in many parts of the world. But historically, that's only made the pleasures of the table more intense.
Drink the wine. Peter in Burlington, Vermont. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Adam Gopnik.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to sound like the cynic, but the comment you just made, you just struck a chord with me. I mean, I think the thing that separates people from animals is that we have conversation, that, you know, we're more about thoughts and feelings and not just about what we eat. Everything eats. And I think that in some ways, this whole thing is it's gotten overblown. I started a health food store in 1986 and ran it with my ex-wife for 15 years, and I think food is great, but it's not what life is about. I think life is about conversation and people and, you know, getting to know people and being human beings, not just putting stuff in our mouths.
I mean, that is so interesting because Adam, in his book, Peter, he makes a lot of this distinction with animals, but he draws it the other way. He says we're different because we can and do think about the meaning of what we're, you know, shoving in our maw. But I don't know, Adam, do we have an over-obsession with food or?
I think we have an over-obsession with food. If will you allow me to read just three lines, I think,
yes,
speak
please.
To that. I tried to organize that thought. We shouldn't intellectualize food because that makes it too remote from our sensory pleasures. But we ought to talk as intelligently as we can about it because otherwise it makes our sensory pleasures too remote from our minds. The knowledge that our senses are part of our intelligence is exactly what makes us human. We alone know our fun. The sweetness in our morning coffee is at once a feeling, an idea, and a memory. All animals eat. An animal that eats and thinks must think big about what it is eating, not to be taken for an animal. And I think exactly that the subject of life is conversation, interchange. But the object which enables us to have that conversation most often at its richest is food.
Take us on your way all the way to Spain, where they're far from the sort of what you describe in some ways as a kind of, you know, passing monarchs of the food scene, the old French sauces and so on. Now they're down into sort of molecular cuisine and really wild kinds of food preparation there. You've got a bit from the famed chef Ferran Adrià in his kitchen in Spain.
I went up to Barcelona as part of this search for the meaning of food, and I had a conversation with Ferran Adrià. And one of the things we were talking about was their search for hot ice cream. He and his brother Albert are going to trying to find the holy grail of hot ice cream. We were talking
whatever
about
that
sweet
is.
And savory. Exactly. They're kind of the mad Willy Wonkas of the food world. And I wrote, turning the pages of his book while drawing rapid diagrams and speaking in even more rapid Spanish, Ferran went on to explain that the true point of his deconstructed desserts was to create a kind of analytic cubism of the pastry plate. It wasn't an intrinsic part of Black Forest cake's nature that made you want to break it down into bits, but that if you're possessed by the urge to break things down into bits, it's more obvious that you're doing it when you do it to Black Forest cake. If we make a curry ice cream and you put mushrooms there and eels, strange, he said. But if you put chicken stock and coconut, then it's curry. Were we, I asked him anxiously, on the verge of entirely breaking down the line between sweet and savory? He looked at me with delighted triumph. It can't be that an American is asking me that, he said. A hamburger with ketchup and Coca-Cola. That's the most intense symbiosis of sweet and savory imaginable, and it's your cultural theme.
I love that. We think all the weirdness is elsewhere. No, he says, the great Spaniard, a hamburger with ketchup and Coca-Cola.
To Barcelona to see these geniuses who were crossing the lines between sweet and savory. He said, no, it's what Americans do every day.
Order it up, grill it up, serve it up.
Exactly.
Adam Gopnik is with us. Gretchen's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Gretchen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call, Tom, and hi, Adam. I just wanted to talk about the meaning of the preparation of food, and I feel like so much of the meaning that we give to food in our family is that we're preparing it in the kitchen with, I remember cooking with my grandmother and my mother, and now my kids, I've gotten my kids tasting all sorts of different things. I remember just recently running through the aisles of the grocery store to have them find a duck leg, and so they could help make duck ragu from this little book called Hungry Monkey, and just the meaning of going into the kitchen together and cooking together and making something for each other to eat. But just carry on that tradition, and is so special and so important in our family.
Gretchen, thank you. There's so much about preparation and recipes in here, including Adam Gopnik indulges himself in a long-distance, time-traveling kind of correspondence with the now-forgotten English writer Elizabeth Pennell, the 19th-century sort of happy glutton who's all into recipes and food and preparation and viscerally enjoying.
Yeah, absolutely. She was a wonderful writer, sort of Nigella Lawson before her time. She wrote this great book called Diary of a Greedy Woman. And I had the notion of sort of having an imaginary email correspondence with her, in part, Tom, because I wanted to be sure to fill the book with food itself. You know, there's lots of thinking and a lot of history here, but I wanted to be sure that there were recipes for rice pudding and lists of my favorite way of making lamb with saffron and cinnamon, because ultimately we're coming back to the particulars. That's one of the joys of food, ingredients, specificities. So I imagine just writing to this great glutton of the 100 years ago about how all tastes have changed from her time to ours, but also offering her recipes in little storytelling narrative form. So I give my three ways of making rice pudding. And somebody who reviewed the book told me that they had tasted and tested all three. So you get rice pudding's a fascinating thing, right? Because we're talking about the continuities of food across the continents. And Elizabeth Luard has this wonderful book, Sacred Food. And almost every civilization uses rice pudding for weddings, funerals, rites of passage. Rice pudding is sort of the universal ritual meal. And it's certainly my favorite dessert.
You know, I wonder why you think we're so obsessed in the media now with food. I was reading Adam Platt in the New York Magazine. He said more people on average now watch the Food Network than CNN. Throw in the other hit food shows, No Reservations, Top Chef, all that. You know, and it's even an audience that dwarfs almost anything outside of ESPN. And he's right. What is that about?
Well, isn't it crazy? If you had said to people at the beginning of television, one of the most popular things will be people showing food that you cannot smell, cannot taste, and will never eat. Yeah. It seems insane, right? But I think the reason is simply that M.F.K. Fisher, the greatest food writer in America, once said, when I write about food, I write about hunger. And when we look at food, we're thinking about hunger, so that even if you can't smell it or you can't taste it, you're engaged with hunger. The other thing that I think is crucial about that is, what are all those Food Channel programs really about? Mm. They're about craft. They're about skill. They're about competitive craft and competitive skill. You don't just get to throw it out there. And in a culture like ours, in which craft has become more and more marginalized, we really value it when we see it, whether it's people dancing well or people cooking well. We say, yes, that's hard, and I admire somebody who's mastered a difficult thing. I think that's the core of our fascination with food we cannot eat.
You say taste changes every generation or so, 20, 30 years, and taste is not what it was. Can you project? Can you see where we're headed? Can you imagine?
Well, one of the things that haunts me in that way is it's perfectly possible that 100, 200 years from now, our descendants will look back on our meat-eating habits with the same shock that we look back on the slave-owning or public hanging habits of our ancestors. A veal chop maybe is an obscene term 200 years from now as a chattel slave was. And I'm conscious of that. And one of the things I wanted to kind of argue out in the book in a very complicated way was the rights and wrongs of meat eating. I would suspect that that might very well be what happens. I think almost every family I know knows that kids tend to turn in the vegetarian direction now more and more. I suspect that that will happen. At the same time, I am still a carnivore, and I believe that it's perfectly appropriate and right to eat the whole beast if you eat it wholly.
That's not a movement that you're going to be out front in leading away from that.
No, not. I don't think so. But I'm well conscious of its centrality and its and the power of its arguments.
Adam Gopnik's new book is The Table Comes First, Family France and the Meaning of Food. Adam, it's been a delight. Thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Oh, I've had such a good time, Tom, and thank you and your listeners.
Listeners, thanks for joining us, and what good, well-considered, well-enjoyed eating to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.